Revelation chapter 14. We've been in this chapter now for a couple of weeks, but we're about to finish it up and trust that this will be a great help to us here this evening. Notice in Revelation chapter 14, verse number 19, the scripture says, "And the angel thrust in his sickle into the earth and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And the winepress was trodden without the city, and blood came out of the winepress, even unto the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs." Now, as I said, we've been in chapter 14 here for a couple of weeks. Last week, we talked about the three angels and their messages. One was good and two were bad. One was about the everlasting gospel. That's great that even in the middle of the tribulation that the gospel is being preached. And we also noticed the two bad were about judgments to come. Now, these are warnings. Back in the days when the British Navy ruled the seas, you would sometimes have a situation in which case a captain of one ship might have to fire what they called a warning shot. And they would say that shot across the bow was just simply an indication that, listen, I need you to do this, and if you don't, the next shot is going to be right at you. It's a sign of impending judgment. You know, I think when you read Revelation chapter 14, this is God's shot across the bow. And it's God basically here just simply indicating, listen, judgment is coming. Here's a chance. Here's a chance for salvation. That's exactly what you have with these three angels, with their messages. Not one, not two, but three shots across the bow. Now, where are we at? Chapter number 14 is interesting because, again, it is one of those parenthetical chapters. We mentioned there are seven in the book of Revelation. This is actually right in the middle, the fourth of seven chapters. Now, it's really where God is sort of even giving us as many of these parentheses. A parentheses will give you additional information. The additional information is important so we understand how God judges and how just our God is. Now, it concludes here with two harvests. There's one, we think, of grain. There's another one of grapes. Again, this is parenthetical. It's going to amplify what is about to come. Now, this is hard to understand because there are different interpretations. And I will tell you, you might come up with one of two different conclusions. Now, different interpretations, for instance, the second one is a little bit easier to understand. The second harvest, the one of grapes, is obviously bad. Grapes equal blood. That's not good. So there's bloodshed that's going to be shed. And we've even got within the symbolism here horses. Horses are instruments of war. Back in those days, they weren't, you know, so much for just simply riding recreationally. But whenever you had horses, horses were today like you'd have tanks and planes and, you know, even drones, you know, different, you know, military, weapons that would be used. A horse was the unit that they used back in Bible days. Now, obviously, the second harvest is bad, that bloodshed. But I would also, by the way, even disagree is exactly what is being talked about in my particular Bible. And sometimes, by the way, you have to understand when you are reading your Bible, the text is fine, but the notes are not inspired. You do understand that, right? That's why sometimes you'll read in your notes, they will sometimes index, categorize, and above the verses, this particular section, in my Bible, it says a vision of Armageddon. Now, I'm just nitpicking a little bit here. I wouldn't disagree, by the way, that this is the final battle, but you do realize, and we'll get to it here in a couple of chapters, the final battle doesn't take place in Armageddon. Armageddon is only the place where they gather. That's not the final battle. The final battle actually takes place at Jerusalem. That's the place. Jesus comes where the final battle is. He comes where the Antichrist has been ruling, reigning. He comes to unseat him. He comes to Jerusalem. That's why the Mount of Olives, right there. The final battle is not Armageddon, but Jerusalem. Now, I would not disagree that the second harvest certainly illustrates the final battle. But what exactly is the first harvest? Now, I will tell you there's different interpretations. For instance, some see the first harvest being something good. maybe a harvesting of souls, maybe the 144,000. And I wouldn't disagree, by the way, that harvesting, in a sense, is a great way to look at people getting saved. And the Bible uses that analogy. Think about Jesus. Jesus, when he was on this earth, when he, of course, led the Samaritan woman to himself, Jesus said to his disciples, "Lift up your eyes and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest." You know, we need to be concerned about the harvest. Perhaps the harvest, some would say, of the 144,000. Others see the first harvest as being a harvest of tribulation saints. Maybe it's not the 144,000, but just in general, those who get saved during the tribulation. Then there are others that they see, and we'll have a picture of this one here. They see the first harvest as being a harvest of tares. Now, what is that? Well, Jesus told many things. He told parables, stories. And one of the stories, parables that he told, is the parable of the wheat and the tares. It's found in Matthew 13, in which case Jesus likened the kingdom of heaven to a man that sowed good seed wheat, and he had an enemy that came, and in the night he came and sowed tares. And so they grew up together, and so he said, listen, don't worry about it. You know, at the end, I will come and I will go ahead and gather them together and separate the wheat from the tares. Now, there are those who actually say that what you see in this first harvest is Jesus actually separating tares from wheat, separating those who are saved from those who are not. Now, that's a popular interpretation. I don't think it's the right one. I think it's actually fraught with what I would call a lot of hermeneutical missteps. There's a lot of things that when you're interpreting Scripture, you have to be consistent and you've got to, you know, take verses in context. For instance, there's nothing in the book of Revelation, it never mentions tares. In addition, there's nothing about this harvest where there's any separating. There's nothing that compares to the parable of Christ. Now, both of these harvests, I'll tell you what I think they are. I think that both of these harvests, they are both basically preparing us for the final judgments, the last seven judgments, which are the vial or bowl judgments. Now, to summarize, here's what I think. Now, I think that the grain harvest is an illustration of the seven vial judgments. Now, in general, just take all of them, the grape harvest is an illustration of the final battle's bloodshed. Now, combine that, they form an illustration, basically a final push of the judgments. This is introductory. After this, we're getting ready here in just a couple of chapters here to get to the end. And the end comes very quickly. The point about it is this, that when you start chapter number 14, now you find that those who have believed in the Lamb, they are secure with the Lamb on Mount Zion. Those who are not, they're not saved, they are in danger of judgment. Judgment is coming. The rejecting world is not safe. Only those who have trusted the Lamb are safe. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, why not just simply get to the judgments? You know, there's a reason why God, you know, a lot of Christians, you know, they want just simply the Cliff Notes version on everything. Just simply the summary, just give me the final points, bullet points, and then let's get going. But you miss some important teaching. You miss something important. Why? It's sort of like, you know, those that, you know, may, you know, come to, for instance, you know, the Super Bowl. Super Bowl oftentimes, you know, is on a night when we've got a church service. I would never, you know, miss church to watch the Super Bowl. But, you know, occasionally here I'll watch the Super Bowl after the Super Bowl and I'll go home. And sometimes we've got these things recorded and you can then with a recording, what can you do? You can fast forward past all those commercials. Or maybe you like the commercials. I don't know. But it's fun to just simply fast forward a game. You know, is much shorter when you can fast forward in between all the in-between plays and just get. Now, that's what a lot of people want to do with the Bible, too. Why not just fast forward? Why not just get to the judgments, get this over? Why not be done? I'll tell you why. Because it's complicated. And one of the things that we learn when we look at this chapter is that judgment is not so simple. It's sort of like this. Can you see the straight line? Can you see where this guy is trying to walk? I'll tell you what, it's sort of, you know, like this. We take a lot of decisions, and a lot of decisions, when they, at first glance, you know, you might say, guilty. But then all of a sudden, when you start hearing the case and you start hearing the evidence, you're not sure. So it is when it comes to judgment. You know, in preparing for this lesson, I read a commentary that actually listed 15 separate judgments that God conducts, all listed within the Bible. There's some judgments for the unsaved, some for the saved. Obviously, the greatest unsaved judgment is the great white throne judgment in chapter number 20. But in the meantime, God is just, and he goes through a process. He is judging the world. Now, here's what we need to learn from this chapter. In a practical sense, we are to pattern our judgments after a just God. We are supposed to look at what he does and say, we need to do that. We need to do that in our world. I'm not going to have you turn there, but I think many of you are familiar with Matthew 7. In verse number 1, where Jesus said, judge not that ye be not judged. For with what judgment ye judge, ye shall be judged, and with what measure ye meet, it shall be measured to you again. I want to let you know that as much as possible, I try and stay out of everybody's business. I think that's a wise plan. I try and stay out of most people's business. Why? Because it's complicated, and the Bible even warns us about what we call meddling. Getting, and some people, by the way, they love being in everybody's business. They love commenting. You know, they love weighing in on everything. You know, what the neighbors are doing, and you know, what the kids at school are doing, and what the moms and dads are doing, what the boss at work, what the coach of the little league is doing. They like to comment about the big person getting in the little car and the little person getting in the SUV. They like to comment about this person's habit and that person's lack of this. Tell you what, that's a dangerous trend. When you start judging everybody and everything, what God says is, listen, same can turn on you. If you're going to judge that way, don't be surprised. You are judged in the same manner. By the way, that's exactly what happened in the case of Job and his friends. Here's Job. Job is suffering. He had three so-called friends, and even his wife, by the way. Everybody wants to weigh in and tell Job what to think. You know, sometimes it's just simply wise to keep our mouths shut. Sometimes it's wise to just simply sit there and just simply console, comfort, encourage. Don't try and weigh in on everybody and everything. Which is not to say that we are never to judge or make judgments. But when we do, let me just suggest letter A. We must remove our partiality. Jesus talked about this when he talked about illustration of a man. Man's got a splinter, in the other guy's eye, and he says, hey, you got a splinter in your eye, but he doesn't pay any attention to the big old beam in his own. Jesus said, that's wrong. You're hypocritical. Take care of the big beam in your eye, and then you can remove the little splinter in somebody else. We've got to remove our partiality. Secondly, we need to judge only according to God's word. And third, we need to judge only when we are supposed to. Otherwise, we're supposed to stay out. You know, a bit of personal transparency here, pastoring a church. How do you pastor a church? I will tell you that when I look at my life, 60, almost 61 years of age, I can tell you that I have lived, in a sense, here two lives. I have lived a life of pastor, that's the last 20 years. I have also lived a life of being pastored. I had a pastor over me for the first 40. I've lived in two different worlds. I've lived on two different sides. And I will tell you this, that one of the things that has served me well, both sides of the fence, is this thing about a call. You see, I happen to believe that God calls men and women to service. I believe that very strongly. For instance, the Bible tells us in Ephesians 4 that God calls some. He gave some apostles and prophets and some evangelists and some pastors and teachers. I am a God-called pastor. I believe that firmly. Now, pastoring a church, I will tell you, is not as easy as you might think. I've talked almost every day to my son since he took over pastoring a small church in Michigan. Boy, you would think, by the way, small churches wouldn't have big problems, but they do. And big churches just have more big problems. But one of the biggest challenges, and I talk to pastors, I've got pastor friends everywhere, all across the country, even across the world, sometimes missionaries, they are pastors as well. And one of the things that I have grown accustomed to is the friends of mine that are pastoring, they are not big into judging. If they were, it would be a problem. But they just simply love to mind their own business, and they love to stay out of other people's business. I will tell you, you know, that two things that all pastors struggle with. One is to try and keep everybody together. Unity is elusive. And secondly, to just simply get people to follow. You know, the Bible likens us people to sheep. A pastor to a shepherd, it's no different. It's a challenge trying to get everybody on the same page and everybody following. The Bible says, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. By the way, that's not a knock on you. That is just simply talking about individual humanity, that we all like to be individuals doing our own thing. That's the way it is. But when it comes to a church, you have to try and follow God. And you have to try and follow the Lord. And it's not so simple. You know, without getting into too many details, over the years, I've had different individuals who have come. And they've come in sincerity. They have also come, if I can say it here with a little bit of naivety, they came, you know, coming in my office and said, you know, Pastor, I remember a couple of men one time, they came into my office and said, Pastor, we want to help you. And so we proposed to do this. And they had all of these plans. They wrote them down on a piece of paper. The problem was, as I told them, I said, you know what? You've never been a pastor, have you? You don't understand. That's not how it works. You know, for instance, you can't just simply say, we're going to do something, and people show up. You can't, I remember I even, you know, had to learn that very early when I was, you know, youth pastor here 35 years ago. I came in, and one of the things I did, I didn't realize, you know, but I just simply scheduled youth activities. I scheduled a youth activity every single week. Guess what happened? They didn't come every single week. Just because I scheduled it, you know, they all of a sudden, because that's too much. That's too regular. Imagine, Pastor Ryan, if you were to schedule every single Saturday, every single week, and just because you build it doesn't mean they come. See, what I'm talking about is it's not so simple. It's complicated. You know, I remember when Pastor John Melly, when he actually came and I had hired him to be my assistant pastor some 20 years ago. It was soon after that that the Lord led in his life and in our ministry to send him to become the pastor of Hope Baptist Church. And I can remember as Pastor Melly was leaving my office, and as he was going to cease being my assistant and now he was going to pastor a little church, I can remember saying to Pastor Melly with a smile on my face, I said to him, Pastor Melly, I sure hope you enjoy your staff unity from now on. And I said that with sort of tongue in cheek. What was I saying? Pastor Melly was going to a ministry where there was only one staff member himself. And I said, you know what, enjoy your unity. I said, you know, try keeping 30, 35 people together on staff. It's not easy, and we've got good staff members. We've got the greatest staff members. But I said, listen, it's not that simple. There are times when we have difficulties, times when we could just simply do this or that. And one of the things I learned is not to make quick judgments, not to make judgments about a lot of things. Church is a family. And sometimes families have problems. Sometimes families, I liken a church sometimes to a friendly game of bumper cars. You ever done the little kids' bumper cars? Yeah, once in a while you get somebody who's not so nice. And they're not trying to do the little bump, but they're trying to plow you in. And they're trying to, you know, bump you really hard. And all of a sudden, the same happens in a ministry. That's why we've got to learn to be forgiving and forbearing. That's why I trust, by the way, and I'm not saying all of this here so you can have sympathy for the pastor. But I'm trying to tell you that I have learned that not only as a pastor, but also as a people, it's not so simple. You know, I can't judge you any more simplicity with any more. I say it many, many times. You've heard me say this many times. Simple's my favorite word. I just don't get to use it because it's not that simple. It's not that simple. It's much more complicated. That's why you've got to look at this situation here in Revelation 14. And when God is judging, you have to appreciate His justice because He is judging everybody in every time, in every circumstance. That is why this gives us a good template that when we are considering judging, we need to look at God who is perfect, who is right. He's righteous. What is Revelation 14 about? It's really explaining to us the valuable perspective of how just God really is. There are two harvests in this chapter, both of which describe and illustrate the manner in which a righteous judge judges righteously. It contrasts really two different people and two different outcomes. It answers these two questions. First of all, what happens to those who refuse to receive the mark of the beast? They're safe. What happens to those who accept the mark of the beast? They're not safe. They are in danger of judgment. In John's vision, John sees the remaining judgment of the tribulation as two harvests. In the beginning of chapter 14, the safe are with the Lamb. In the end, they face the wrath of the Lamb, those who accept the mark of the beast. Both of these harvests, the last two harvests, they involve three things: a harvester, a sickle, and the harvesting. Now let's notice, first of all, the grain harvest in verses 14 through 16. Verse number 14, John begins by saying this, "And I looked, and behold." It's an interesting introductory phrase. It's very familiar. John oftentimes used this. He said, "I looked, I beheld, I looked." He uses it oftentimes to just simply say, there's new territory, new things we need to look at now, a new subject matter. Notice what he saw, a white cloud. That's interesting because at first glance there, you think white is white. However, this particular word describes not just simply a color, but a color that seems to glow, a color that seems to jump out at you, a color that seems to be brilliant. In fact, this is actually the same word that's used of Christ on the Mount of Transfiguration. In other words, He glowed. It was showing His glory. It's the glory of the Lord. Notice not only that, a white cloud, and by the way, cloud, but notice upon the cloud one sat like unto the Son of Man, and then notice, having on His head a golden crown and in His hand a sharp sickle. Now this description, though it's debated by many scholars, I think obviously is Jesus Christ. I believe Jesus is seen here. Why? Because now in order to talk about the judgment of God, you have to have the judge. And who's the judge? Just like in any courtroom, all of a sudden the door opens and a robed man may come behind a bench or a robed woman may come behind a bench. You have the Lord Himself. You've got Jesus Christ. He descends and He judges. So you've got the introduction of Jesus. By the way, whether He does it in person or He sends His angels, we know that Jesus is the righteous judge. You might even recall in the book of Daniel, Daniel saw something similar in a description, Daniel 7:13. And I saw in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man came with the clouds of heaven and came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought Him near before Him. We find here in Revelation 14 that Jesus is wearing a crown, a gold crown, not a crown of ruling, a diadem, but rather a crown of conquering. This is the victor's crown. Jesus is triumphant. Therefore, He is worthy now to judge. John also tells us that Jesus is holding a sharp sickle in His hand. A sickle was a long, curved, razor-sharp blade that was usually attached to a handle. It's what they used in the fields. It's how they harvested the ancient grain. that they would cut it down. The grain stalks, they cut it down at ground level, then pick it up and put it in sheaves. Notice in verse 15, and another angel came out of the temple crying with a loud voice to him that sat on the cloud, thrust in thy sickle and reap, for the time is come for thee to reap, for the harvest of the earth is ripe. And we have another angel, the fourth actually in this chapter. There's going to be a couple more as well. But this one here comes out of the temple in heaven, comes out directly with the power, the authority of God. Now, again, you say, well, why all the detail? I'll tell you why. Because God is trying to let you know that he dots his I's and he crosses his T's. He's trying to let you know that he doesn't miss anything. He's letting you know that he's got a formality. He's got a punctuality. He's got a precision, a process. Everything he do. You and I, by the way, we could learn from that. You ever, with your kids, mom and dad, don't raise your hand on this, but have you ever been angry and made a decision with your kids? You ever, blurted something out in frustration at your children? That your children are misbehaving, and boy, you just, that's why you and I, we can't just simply look at this thing and say, well, boy, there's nothing for us to learn. Maybe one of the things that we can learn is to get under control. Maybe one of the things we can learn is to make sure that we don't fly off the handle. That here we find that Jesus, when he comes, that everything is in his control. He's not out of control. Notice this angel cries out, thrust in thy sickle and reap. For the time has come and the harvest of the earth is ripe. It's interesting, that word ripe, it actually means past ripe. It means, there's a time when you've actually missed the harvest. That's why Jesus said, look on the fields, they're white already to harvest. You don't want to go a little bit after that. All of a sudden, you're going to find that grain has all of a sudden withered, dried, and it's worthless. It's only good to just simply be gathered up and burned, and that's exactly where they're at. He said, listen, it's ripe. It's past ripe. It's no good. It's been too late for them. So therefore, John writes in verse 16, and he that sat on the cloud thrust in his sickle on the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now this, as I said, I believe this first harvest, it's just simply summarizing here, there are seven judgments that are going to wrap it up. Seven judgments, if you want to say it this way, the grain harvest is just simply summarizing the seven vial or bowl judgments. That's what it is. Why is that important? That's what precedes Jesus coming. Before Jesus comes to reign, he judges the earth. Not only do we have the grain harvest in verses 14 through 16, but secondly, notice specifically the grape harvest. In verses 17 through 20, this speaks about the bloodshed at the final battle of the tribulation. As I said, it's at Jerusalem. And we find that the harvester in this case here is not the Son of Man, not Jesus, but there's actually another angel, a fifth angel in this chapter, who assists Christ. That we know from other scriptures that the Son of Man will be assisted by angels in this final judgment. So this angel comes bearing a sharp sickle. And then another angel, sixth one, appears in verse 18. And another angel came out from the altar which had power over fire. That's interesting. Power over fire. This angel is actually coming from the altar of incense. You might recall the altar of incense pictured prayers. Earlier in the book of Revelation, the prayers of the saints came before God. God heard their prayers. Now the answer is justice. Boy, we've got a world that is crying out for justice. I'm not sure they really want justice, because when Jesus comes, justice will come. We find the prayers being answered. We find that now justice will be served. And how? Is going to result with blood. You might recall, as I said earlier in the book of Revelation, that the saints, the martyred ones, the ones who had their blood shed, said this, how long before you avenge our blood? You say, Pastor, why does this chapter have to be so gory, bloody? I'll tell you why. It's just. Jesus, if you want to even say it this way, look at the beginning of the book of Genesis. One of the verses early on in Genesis, after the flood, God came to Noah and he said this, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by him shall man's blood be shed. What's he saying? It's fair, just. You shed blood, your blood shed. You shed blood, blood is going to be the just deserved result. So that's why. Because they've been shedding blood. Notice justice leaving the altar. This angel, verse 19, thrust in his sickle and gathered the vine of the earth and cast it into a great winepress of the wrath of God, the result of which is this is catastrophic. There's bloodshed. Now, the enemies of God who survive the seven vile judgments, they do not survive the bloodshed. That is fitting. That is basically saying that God is going to exact perfect justice. Now, you might not be familiar. I show you this picture here because, again, you know, most of us, when it comes to grape juice, you know, we're just simply, we go to the store and it's already bottled for us. But we don't know the ancient process involved basically a two-tiered basin, a top and a lower basin. The bottom basin, there was sort of a channel that kind of cut to the lower basin. And basically what they did is they took the grapes, and of course they washed their feet before doing this, but then they'd stomp the grapes. And they would squish the grapes and squish out all of that juice. And it would run into the lower basin. They'd catch it. That's how they got their... They didn't go to the store and find it in the bottle. They did it that way. That is why the description is used here. In verse number 20, it needs a little bit more explanation. And the wine press, that's what we're seeing right here. The wine press was trodden without the city. And blood came out of the wine press, even under the horse bridles, by the space of 1,600 furlongs. These verses, I believe, are describing the final battle. The final battle, as I said, the epicenter of which is Jerusalem, where Jesus descends. He stands on the Mount of Olives. On the other hillside, you've got the beast, the first beast, the Antichrist. He's seated there. In between is the Valley of Decision, the Kidron Valley. It's a bloodbath, and it's like squishing grapes as all of a sudden there's bloodshed everywhere, the splattering of grapes. Now, obviously, this is going to be earth, and mankind is going to be assembled here. There are going to be millions upon millions of people here. The final battle is the greatest assembly of military might in men the world has ever seen. Millions are going to be involved. Now, there's this description that I want to talk about. It says, blood came out of the winepress under the horse bridles by the space of 1,600 furlongs. There's two ways you can take this. You can either take this literally, or you can view this particular phrasing here as, it's a literary technique, we call it hyperbole. Hyperbole is, you know, when you take something and you basically elaborate it here with an exaggeration of sorts, and you use that exaggeration on purpose here to illustrate it's big. It's not to say, by the way, that there's not going to be some places where there's going to be bloodshed in ditches, and even you might even look at them as little pondings and little places where little rivers of blood, certainly with so many people being killed and their blood shed. But if you take this literally, then you're going to assume here that there's going to be a river that's going to be 4 feet deep that's going to flow for 180 miles. That's the translation. Okay, I happen to lean toward this being hyperbole. By the way, 180 miles. It's described here as 1,600 furlongs. That translates to 180 miles. You know what that distance represents? That actually represents the entire distance, the length of the nation of Israel. And I happen to believe, by the way, Jerusalem being the epicenter, what he's describing there, hyperbole, he's describing the nation of Israel is going to be a bloodbath. He's describing that the nation of Israel is going to be the place where Jesus Christ brings about justice, and yes, it does include the shedding of blood because that is just. Now, notice again as we get ready to conclude a little bit that God is really wrapping things up marvelously. You see, today is a day of grace and mercy. But just as God said in the book of Genesis, my spirit shall not always strive with man. There's coming a day when God says, it's over. As I said, Even that one angel, as I spoke about last week with the message, the gospel, that's the last altar call. That's the last invitation. That's the last time. Eventually here, God is going to say, it's too late. There comes a time when it's over. In this chapter, in these verses, we see two extremes. One that's safe, one that is not. One that is with the Lamb, one that is with the beast. As I conclude, I wanted to just bring this in because it became part of my title for tonight. One of the most popular patriotic anthems of all time is called the Battle Hymn of the Republic. It was written during the days of the Civil War on November the 17th, 1861. Julia Ward Howe traveled with her husband. He had a responsibility, an advising role with the Army. They visited at one time a Union camp just outside of Washington, D.C., and when they were visiting, they heard a catchy tune. It happened to be the tune to John Brown. The little chorus that they would sing there about John Brown, the abolitionist hero. And hearing that tune, Julia Ward Howe said, listen, I'd like to change the words. I like the tune, but I want to change the words. What she did, if you'll listen, is she changed the words into being very fitting for prior to the second coming of Christ. Because what she wrote were these words. Listen to them. It fits exactly this chapter. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. I have seen him in the watchfires of 100 circling camps. They have builded him an altar in the evening dews and damps. I can read his righteous sentence by the dim and flaring lamps. His day is marching on. He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat. He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat. Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on. In the beauty of the lilies, Christ was born across the sea with a glory in his bosom that transfigures you and me. As he died to make men holy, let us die to make men free while God is marching on. Glory, glory, hallelujah. His truth, of course, the chorus says, is marching on. Do you realize, by the way, that just really describes that he is going to be coming again. When he does, he's coming to enact justice. His truth is marching on. That's why really this chapter here, if you watch it and notice it very carefully, it describes here the exact justice that the judge exacts is the same pattern for you and I. Let's learn from chapter 14. We'll pick it up here next week.